everybody, and welcome to another episode of Tales from a Vet Tech with me, Tabitha Kucera. Today, I am speaking to the awesome Melissa Taylor, who is the Behavior and Training Manager at Friends for Life Animal Shelter in Houston, Texas. We are talking how to build relationships between animal care and medical teams in the shelter setting, how to engage volunteers, leverage their volunteer skills and strengths and empower them, how to find volunteers, and also all about the amazing programs that Melissa and her team have implemented at their shelter. You don't want to miss it. Also, disclaimer, I'm on Mucinex. I caught a bit of a cold at VMX. So please be kind if I am stumbling over my words or I sound a little nasally, because the show must go on. Hi, Melissa. Thank you so much for taking time today to hang out with me and my listeners. Welcome.
Hey, Tabitha. I'm so excited to be here. And I cannot believe that you asked me to do this.
She's a big deal, guys. You know, all of us animal professionals got that imposter syndrome hard. But Melissa's amazing. I met her in the behavior world and then the smaller behavior world of cat behavior. And then the smaller world of animal welfare cat behavior. So I love her and all she does. So I had to bring her on and we'll probably have her back. But I figured to get started, can you share with my listeners a little bit about you and your career path and how you got to where you are today?
Sure. Yeah. So like a lot of people, I started by loving animals early on. And my mom actually worked with dogs. So she did some dog training, and that was really, you know, fabulous to me to watch her train these giant Akitas, and I was so tiny. and you know, that happens to a lot of people, but somehow I fell into being part of I was an editor for a dog owners group in New York City. And I didn't really do so much else. I was finished with school. I was trying to figure out where I was going to go. And one day on New York One, it popped up that there was this internship at the ASPCA in New York City, the Animal Behavior Center. And this was under Pam Reed, who some folks might know. I think she was an amazing, amazing person to learn from. She continues to be my mentor to this very day. And so I called them and I was like, I really want to, you know, do this internship. I filled out my application and it turns out I was rejected. So sad. But because I was so, you know, so gung-ho about it, they eventually gave me a slot that was
persistent, y'all.
Yes, yes. Persistent, annoying.
I call it persistence, Melissa.
Annoyingly persistent. But yeah, tenacious. So I turned out to be pretty good, if I do say so. I got the highest score in my cohort. And I thought, gee, I might want to do this. And so, you know, I ended up being a behavior evaluator at the Animal Care and Control in New York City at the time, which was a tough job, but one of the most rewarding jobs that I've ever had. I learned so much. I'm not joking, attacked every single day on the job because it's going to sound so terrible, but this was the time. It's a sign of the times because let's see, how many years ago was it? So I've been in this job for about 25 years. I've been doing shelter animal behavior for 25 years. And so this was a long time ago. And back then there was a lot of behavior evaluation going on. And I was doing a lot of things that I wouldn't do now.
It looked very different. And even some of the large, thankfully, guys, it's getting a lot better. But a lot of the orgs, what they were promoting as an evaluation, safety and management and other things were not considered back then, which again, that's okay. Like, we grow and get better, but also that put you at risk. probably quite often, unfortunately.
Really dangerous. And for, you know, I don't know what the level of predictive value was for those tests nowadays. But one thing that I learned from that was really how to read dogs before they attacked me. So you see that enough, you start to get good at reading dog body language. And so that was my thing for a long time. Actually, it's funny because that's nowhere near what I do right now. I ended up at a shelter. Anyway, fast forward because there's a lot of things. I ended up at a shelter here in Houston where this very one, which is a low kill shelter, meaning that this shelter holds on to our animals until they can find a home, unless unless there's some kind of welfare concern. So if we see them declining, but we don't euthanize for space.
Right.
So.
And thank you for defining that, because that'll be a whole nother podcast, but there's some
dangerous
language being used out there in rescue world.
Controversial topic. And I do worry about, you know, no kill, the whole no kill ideology.
Save them all. Some dangerous language out there, especially that the general public misperceives, and a lot of animal welfare professionals misperceive, and it can get really dangerous. Yeah. But I already have a plan to talk about that. Don't you worry.
It's very controversial. I think this would be a super panel discussion to involve a lot of different folks from a lot of different places. And you even heard just in my story, in a little snippet of my story, it came from the municipal animal shelter. And here I am at a shelter that really gives some tougher cases a chance. Always keeping in mind the welfare of the animal. That's the first thing. There's more than one way to save an animal. And
100%.
It's not by keeping them alive forever. So that has to be said. Anyway, so I came over here and they were talking to me about hiring me on. And I had a list of duties. And at the very, 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 very bottom of that list, if I had time, which, you know, shelter folks never have time for anything.
Right.
Cats. If you have time, there are cats in the shelter who may or may not need a behavior modification. You can work with that, with those guys. So fast forward to now. And that's
a lot of your life.
It is. It's a lot of what I do. I spend more than half of my day working with the cats at the shelter. And it's a marvelous place to be because this is where it's needed. There aren't a lot of behavior specialists out there who work with cats, and especially cats in shelters. So here I am.
And I love that. And I also think it's so important because obviously I work with cats and dogs mostly, but I've trained, you know, pigs, birds. Now, is that my specialty? I would 100% refer someone because it is not. But you've worked with dogs a lot. And obviously every animal is there. A cat's a cat, a dog's a dog. But sometimes I meet cat professionals who don't realize the importance of training other species.
Oh, yes.
And it makes us all that education and experience you had working with dogs has helped you so much in working with cats. Because sometimes I think, especially with cat, in my experience with cat behavior professionals, they kind of like put themselves in this box and they're like, if it says dog, I'm not going to that lecture. And I'm like, guys, what are you doing? You can learn. I've learned so much from training a donkey, guys, because it's very different and you have to problem solve and critically think. So I love that you started with dogs, and I'm sure you worked with some other interesting species in between, but found your love because you got that love for them cats for sure.
I do. I think it's because I've always been the rooter of the underdog, undercat, I guess.
I love it. Undercat. New thing we're going to say now.
And yes, it's so important to work with other species because you develop mechanical skills and an eye for behavior that you can't get just from watching the same animals over and over. And I've learned so much from training dogs and horses and some large carnivores. And yeah. And then also rabbits and, you know, the smaller species that might move quite a bit faster, or their prey species, right? Yeah. You really want to get
sheep.
That.
Oh, trading sheep is a whole nother. a whole other thing. But it sounds like you've had an awesome ride to where you are now. And I know you guys have started quite a few amazing programs successfully at your shelter. Can you just briefly talk about a few? Because I know you guys have so many, which is wonderful.
Yes, it's actually a small miracle, I guess, that we have so many programs related to behavior at our shelter. Because when I first started here, the executive director, Celise Shuttlesworth, who is this amazing person, she's a visionary. But when I started, she was very skeptical about behavior in general. She didn't believe in it, I guess. And she famously said that we needed a behavior specialist on staff, like we needed a masseuse on staff. And well, maybe we do. I mean, after all, it's a shelter.
Right.
Very stressful place. I would argue that we do need a masseuse on staff. But one day she saw me working. It just took one time with her watching me work with this one dog. And I mean, her mind was blown. She just saw me teaching a dog to, you know, show some incompatible behaviors to her aggression towards dogs. So this was anyway, I don't know if you want to go into the details, but she saw me working and it changed her mind about what it was.
Teach through showing. This is a huge thing with handling, with behavior, with everything that we do. We can always do the best we can and people notice. Yeah, 100%.
Yes. And I think the most important thing about it was I wasn't trying to show her. I was just there in the lobby and she just happened to walk through and saw that and it blew her mind. And I was actually just about to leave and start working at another shelter. And they said, no, you can't leave. Aww. You can't leave. You've got to stay. So it all started with that. It all started with this one dog who couldn't show at the shelter because she was so reactive to other dogs. And she just stayed at her foster's. And one day the foster said, I've had enough. I don't want to foster this dog anymore. You've got to do something with her. She couldn't come to the shelter. And I said, well, it was just me. There was no behavior department at that time. It was just me. I was a behavior volunteer. I was a volunteer. We didn't have behavior volunteers back then. And I said, can you just give me a couple weeks? And you don't have to do anything except, you know, provide the dog with enrichment in the yard. I didn't tell him to do any behavior modification, any training or anything. Just keep the dog alive and happy and not exposed to triggers.
Right. Like safety and management while you come up with a more in-depth plan, which is a wonderful approach.
Yeah. And just, you know, this is shelter behavior. Like there is shelter medicine, which is another probably very controversial topic. But, you know, we had to just figure something out. We got together. It was me and like three volunteers with no experience. And the dog's name was Summer. And so Summer eventually was so, it didn't take us very long. I want to say it just took 2 or 3 months, which to me is lightning fast.
Oh, 100%. Yeah.
And so she was the best behaved dogs at showings. She could just hang out in the lobby and dogs walk back and forth. And she very quickly got adopted to a family with, you know, folks who just loved her and were able to keep her away from other dogs, you know, and to this day, she lives happily with them. And that was the beginning of the behavior program.
We all have those starting or dream, whatever animals that got us hooked. And
yeah.
We always remember all the animals we work with. But that first one where you,
the first one where, yeah, she was the first one who kind of opened the eyes of our executive director. And that was the start. That was the green light to start our program. And those were our first behavior volunteers. I think that our flagship program in the behavior department is our behavior volunteer program. So right now we have 250 active behavior volunteers. And it is because these folks are gold. We treat them like gold. They're royalty to us. And they start out with, you know, barely any experience at all. I mean, some of them may never have, you know, our cat behavior volunteers may never have handled a cat before, We've had some behavior volunteers now working with cats who were afraid of cats, which is, you know, it's a thing. And the same with dogs. We have folks who work with cats and dogs, and they start out with very little experience, and it's a tiered program. So they start out, you know, just learning about the very, very basics, and they focus on enrichment, and then they focus on, you know, body language, and they focus on, each tier is on a different aspect of shelter animal behavior. And they get to a point where they're working on their mechanical skills with the animals, and they're able to train independently, which is huge because we can use them to help meet our biweekly training goals with our dogs and our cats. And we have a whole bunch of folks who eventually earn their certs, which is a big deal because, like I was saying earlier, there aren't a lot of kind of evidence-based trainers here in Houston, modern trainers for dogs and cats. I think about more than a quarter of all of the, you know, trainer level, like CPDT and the CPDTKA and accredited dog trainer.
IAABC. Or ADPT or C. There's a lot of letters, y'all. I'm like, I know most of them, but.
I think it's ADT, IAABC.
So the trainer, I know what you're talking about.
Trainer,
yes.
Levels. So, you know, about over a quarter of those folks are associated with our program. And so, I mean, it just gives you a sense of how much we've contributed to the dog trainer community here, which is not humongous. Known for being the most progressive.
Yeah. No, I totally understand where you're coming from. Because
I'm not sure how bad the sound was because, you know, shelter world has to go on over here.
Oh, yeah. She's at her shelter, y'all, and people are walking around. But that sounded great. So, and I think when it comes to shelters, because just like I always tell people, whether I'm speaking to a client or a shelter that I'm working with, that mental health, because mental health and physical health, exact same thing. But even our society right now, we're finally starting to grasp the importance of mental health in humans. So as you can imagine, like that example, which was a real life example of you saying she considers it like a massage. That's something that thankfully I hear less and less, which is beautiful. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of shelters don't have access to behavior professionals or evidence-based positive animal welfare professionals. But behavior is, again, I went to a lecture recently and I say this all because I was at VMX. I say this all the time. The biggest killer, sorry guys, I'm fun, of animals is not infectious diseases. It's behavior. Real talk, y'all. So this is something that, which is why as a field, whether we're talking vet med or animal shelters, it's something that we all understand, like, hey, enrichment is a need, guys. It's not a want, addressing these. So I understand that everyone can't have a Melissa or a me at their shelter, but you guys have found an amazing way to empower and engage your community. Because volunteers, guys, there are people out there that want to help. I remember when I was starting as a little baby animal veterinary technician who really loved behavior. And I'm going to be honest, those shelters love me now, but I cannot find a place to utilize my skill set back in the day. And even back then, I was more skilled than most as a veterinary technician. So there are people out there who want to help, and you could build these humongous behavior programs and then not only help the animals, help that volunteer, but also in a way, like Melissa mentioned, really help build up your community. I mean, you guys are doing amazing things. And I think when it comes to engaging, leveraging your volunteer skills and strengths and empowering them, how have you guys, it sounds like you support them a lot during the way you break things down into small steps and set them up for success. But what are some other ways you guys have really been able to keep your volunteers and get them in? Because everybody wants to, a lot of people want to do behavior out there. I know as a fact. So having that supportive starting from the beginning thing is just beautiful.
They do want to get into behavior. And I think you've got an amazing point there, is that shelters need volunteers. They need skilled volunteers. And there are volunteers out there who want to get started. So there's, you know, there's no way you could fail. But yet shelters don't seem to have that need met. I think part of it is that you want to start by setting up a program that's very inviting, where you have a way for volunteers to grow some skill set, because volunteers want to do more than just walk dogs. They might not even know that they want to do more,
100%. Right?
They want to keep growing because it's fulfilling to have that deeper relationship with animals that you can get when you know more and understand them. So by building a program where there's always a place to go, if you want to learn about more about behavior, we have something called Ethogram Evenings, where every Monday, one of our more senior behavior volunteers, and she's amazing, she hosts this remote group, and everyone is welcome to join. So you want to join Ethogram Evenings? Can we share that? I can.
Oh, of course, I would
share
love
the Zoom link, and we just watch videos and talk about what's going on in the video and what the function of behaviors are. So she's right now going through the Barbara Handelman book, that Canine Body Language, a photographic.
Yeah. That's a great one.
And so she's just going through it and then showing examples and talking about what each behavior, what the significance of each behavior is, and function. Because, you know, when you go anywhere where you are interfacing with folks who work with animals or just live with animals, everybody has their ideas about how animals communicate. But where are they getting that from, right? At least we have some sources that we can cite, and we're just training people to kind of understand that the information is coming from somewhere. Anyway, so we have a bunch of activities like that. We have enrichment classes regularly, where members of the public and our volunteers and adopters and staff can, you know, learn about specific types of enrichment so they can practice those with the animals at the shelter and at home. So we give them ways that they can learn and a direction to go in if they want to go into that direction. And then, of course, like I said earlier, we treat our volunteers like royalty, because let's face it, they are taking the spot of so many paid staff members, and they're doing these things for free. And in fact, our more skilled behavior volunteers have folks who qualify as consultants and or are consultants, and they work with members of the public who are on the brink of relinquishing their animals to shelters, or maybe they work with adopters to keep animals in their homes, or maybe they work with our fosters, or they help us fulfill training goals at the shelter. But those are jobs that not everybody at the shelter could do, and they're doing those jobs for free. So yeah, they're royalty.
I think that that's some really great points, because volunteers, understandably, can be challenging due to a variety of reasons. But I think that when I talk to shelters about volunteers, whether it's starting an enrichment program or implementing a kindergarten class or whatever this may look like, I'm like, hey guys, I'm from Ohio, but I could find people in your state who would love to work with you. So I think that engaging volunteers, and that you guys have kind of created, yeah, it was probably a lot of work to create those tiers initially, but that's how it works. Like standard operating protocols, every shelter should have them. That's a whole nother thing. It takes time to create those things, but once they're created, it's fairly easy to do the rest. And like you said, this is having ripple effects that you would have never even imagined. Like animals are staying in their home. You guys don't even hear about the animals. They're not being relinquished. You're empowering those volunteers to stay there. You're empowering those volunteers to say positive things about your shelter. Because guys, that matters. You, how you look in the community matters. And although even if you dislike people, unfortunately, shelter work, a big part of it is people. So doing all of that, it's just amazing. And it sounds like you were very thankful for your volunteers, which is a whole separate, and you treat them like equals. And I know that sounds brand new, but a lot of people are like, you're lucky to be here. I'm really busy. And I'm like, I understand why that volunteer might have left. Or, hey, I will never forget this. my husband is my husband, guys, to be fair. So he does have a background in behavior, essentially, because he's a sweet guy that supports me and has gone to a lot of my events. I remember this was a very long time ago. I was at an event volunteering where it's one of those events where you do vaccines and exams for 500 to 1,000 people in one day. And one of the shift supervisor people had a dog, a very large. This was when I was a technician. I wasn't as into behavior, but even back then, I thankfully knew some stuff. And there was a very large dog who was having an over arousal response. So they were kind of lunging forward and moving around a lot. And there, as you can imagine, there was so much going on around us. And she goes to my partner and says, "Here." And he's like, "I'm not comfortable holding that dog." And I was like, "Fuck yeah." Because how dangerous could have that been? And to be fair, I don't think the person handling that dog was also aware of dog handling skills, to be fair. But I see that happen in vet med and shelter med all the time, where you're thrown into a situation where you were not set up for success. You do not have the skill set, and it sucks for everybody. Not just that animal, but for that volunteer might now, I meet tons of veterinary professionals who are afraid of cats. And a big reason is because they're thrown into situations thinking without being able to assess cat body language and thinking the cat's mean when actually that's obviously not a thing. The cat's fearful or painful. So I think you setting up this volunteer program to set them up for success. And I know a lot of your volunteers from the cat world.
Oh, yeah. That's right. They go on and
they're doing amazing things. Yeah. And a big part, like if I would have had that mentorship, just that Zoom call where we just talked about behavior or even a vet case. Oh, my God. You guys, the power of that when I was starting out, which is why I think both of us strive to do that now. Oh, it would have been like priceless. I would have been like, I love this shelter forever. I'm going to do whatever I need to. And then also like, a volunteer doing it, like I used to do 30-minute calls with people who adopted animals, and I would address some of their main concerns. And it was a fairly simple call for me, but that kept that animal in that home from not being returned because the client was just misunderstanding what the animal was doing and thought the animal hated them. Like, so as far as all that goes, because oh my God, I could just go on and on. What is one piece of advice? I know it's hard because you have so many wisdom. Could you recommend for shelters out there to find not just behavior volunteers, but volunteers in general?
Yeah.
As like a first step.
Wow. You make it so challenging asking me to say one thing about something.
You could say more than one. You were open.
Well, of course, the first thing I'm going to say is, and I've already said this a couple times, I'm sorry for being so repetitive, but I can't say it enough. Just really show the volunteers the respect that they're due and give them every opportunity to succeed, the ones you have now, because they're going to go out and they're going to sing your praises. They're going to say, mm-hmm. This is such a wonderful place to work. I have new skills that I can help people now, either professionally or not. I mean, I've had folks, you know, quit jobs as television producers to go into behavior.
Love it.
And I mean, I've been doing this for so long that I've had folks start and then retire from their career. And they just, you know, I just thinking about that makes me feel old, but it makes me feel so I feel so good. I feel so good about it. But anyway, that's the number one thing I think is just, you can plant the seeds by showing the potential volunteers out there what a wonderful experience they can have by just word of mouth. So that's the number one thing. And I've worked in animal sheltering for a while now in different animal shelters. And every shelter has their strong points. But I would say this is the first time I've ever worked at a shelter where we really get to know our volunteers and treat them, you know, you said as equals. I mean, it's maybe more than that. I don't know.
As part of the staff, like, hey guys, a team effort and we all need each other.
Yes.
I think that's so important.
That's it. And I don't feel like I'm more than any volunteer at the shelter. I mean, I don't make much more than they do. It's okay because I get paid in, you know, the happiness of the animals that I work in and the happiness.
And you get to see, I mean, I think that's another thing about you. And I'm sure you're, because I do know some of your staff, but not all of them. I get to see them in Houston. And I, when I speak at the IABBC conference, and I cannot wait. But it's obvious that you guys spread joy and really care about each other. So I think also you've also worked hard to create a shelter that has a culture of kindness in an, that has an environment that is conducive to learning, not only for the animals, but also for the people. And real talk, in vet med and shelter med, there's a lot of environments I've been put in that were not conducive to learning at all, whether we want to call it toxic, again, all these words. But I think also you guys have worked really hard to create a culture in your shelter that is welcoming and positive, which is something you kind of, that's a foundation really to keep staff, but also of course to keep volunteers.
It's a priority because sheltering is necessarily stressful and
yes,
and easily a toxic stress environment. So if you're not thinking about that, just not just for your staff or your volunteers, it's high time that you do that. And I'm not going to say that this is the ideal place, but I am super thankful that it's something that we think about in the shelter. That's a, it's a priority to us that we, I was telling you earlier, we cry together and that's okay. You know, we all celebrate the lives of our animals together and we sometimes lose them. We've had a lot of loss lately. And I do remember having worked at other shelters where we just never had that conversation. You know, when volunteers would start, it would say, yes, we euthanize animals. And there's that conversation the first day, but then you never talk about it again. And it's kind of like, don't talk about that animal. Yeah. But now whenever we do have to euthanize an animal, we say that the volunteers and ourselves were the next of kin. Like we were that animal's family.
Yeah. And I think talking through all of that, because that's something that I commonly see where an animal may be euthanized for obviously humane reasons, if their quality of life, all of these things, if the resources aren't all the, again, that's a whole nother podcast, but, and then people hear about it, right? And then narratives are created. It's very, a lot of shelters don't have SOPs on euthanasia, which is something I think you guys are making your lives way more challenging. Whoa. Because we're already thrown into challenging emotional situations. So obviously you can't provide every situation, but having a standardized SOP that the staff agrees on and having those volunteers involved. And then when we euthanize an animal, having that conversation and being like, this does fucking suck. This is real life all. Like everybody who like, I used to joke because I worked at a lot of farm sanctuaries. And I am very thankful for the 5 to 7 years I've worked at farm sanctuaries, but I hear a lot of people glamorize it. And I'm like, y'all don't like, man, I mean, it's amazing and I love it, but there's ups and downs in any job, but especially in animal welfare. And us, the fact that you address, say, hey, yeah, this did happen and this sucks, but we're here. Let's talk through it. Mm-hmm. The power of that is just not, I mean, not many veterinary clinics are doing that. Not many shelters are doing that where we talk through a case. And not only are you helping to support mental health of that, those volunteers and staff, you're preventing tension. Ooh, gosh, so much. But you're also allowing people to critically think in the future, right? Like we talk through this. So you may see this happen somewhere else. And obviously, we'll never know all the context. That too, like not just seeing a post and assuming all this stuff and like shaming people, which unfortunately, whew, that happens a lot in shelter med.
It happened to me.
No.
Yes. And this was back when I was a volunteer, and I still remember it to this day. I was volunteering at a shelter, and a dog that I had been working on named Maxine was a BE candidate, and I felt shamed for being so upset about it, and I didn't feel heard, and I didn't want to ever put a volunteer through that because that was, I mean, to this day, I've been traumatized by that. I mean, I still like want to, I still feel so much pain because of that pain.
When I was working at a sanctuary, I had 500 animals. There's only like five caregivers. Good times. And again, I will never forget this either. I literally was just talking to someone about this story at VMX. We had to break, like at the end of our shift, we would put all the animals kind of in their areas, and we would always, they had like, this was a very progressive sanctuary. So they had quite a lot of room, and like the ducks had their own pond. And so every night you would count them all and get them in before dusk. I'm going to cry. Sorry. I'm fine. And if I do cry, it's fine, guys. You guys know I'm emotional in real life. And I was counting and I couldn't find one of the ducks. So we had walkie talkies and I was like, I need help finding this duck, blah, 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 blah. I found the duck. Unfortunately, most likely a fox or some other type of animal injured and killed the duck. And the next day, I was a wee little baby tech. I was like a year out of school. This was a very long time ago. The boss lady essentially shamed me and told me it was my fault and screamed at me. And guys, guess what I did? I quit and left. So back then, I'm very proud of myself because I've grown a lot. And back then, I had very little boundaries and huge imposter syndrome. But I'm still very affected by it. It's still, just thinking about it makes me want to sob. So I think that's great that you took those traumatic experiences. I'm sorry you went through that, but you're using that to help prevent other people from having to go through what you, because I think that's all we can do, right? Like, mm-hmm. How can we take what we went through and help others not have to deal with that same stuff? And you have done that in so many ways at your shelter. And even as a colleague and as a friend, oh, we're getting emo, guys. Mm-hmm. We're both gonna cry. I think all of that kind of having real life conversations, and honestly, keeping staff and volunteers, a big part of that is just including them in the conversation. Because I think whether it's something I see a lot, whether it's the ED and the managers talking and all of the shelter staff are completely like not talked to or addressed, or the, again, with the volunteers, that's a really, really common thing, even at really small shelters. And I'm like, you guys are making it way harder on yourselves.
Yeah. Yes. Gosh, I could go on and on about it. And I do. I have to be stopped. But yeah, I mean, if you say, so when I first thought about the idea of, you know, where do you get volunteers? You get volunteers by planting the seeds in the volunteers you have, by making sure that they're valued members of your shelter family. I think that if we always did that, if shelters did that, I would love to see shelters pursue a change in how they address their volunteers and see how that changes their numbers. Because
data.
And it's because, you know, I've been at a couple different shelters and this is the first shelter that I've been at. And I don't want to say that maybe times haven't changed for the other shelters, because I don't know. But this is the only shelter that I've worked at where we really really uplift and include our volunteers, and by no means perfect. We're always trying to get better.
Oh, of course.
Oh, you know, by the way, here's something else that we do that I think is really huge, is we get to know our volunteers. So not just what they do, you know, with the animals at the shelter, but you know, what are their backgrounds? And we try to incorporate their superpowers into what they do at the shelter if they want. You know, obviously some people might be like, okay, I've had enough. You know, we have some professional dog walkers and they don't want to walk any animals. Okay. Yeah. You know, you don't want to do that, that's fine. But some people have areas of expertise that they are delighted to use in the cause of animal welfare. For example, we have some data analysts on board.
Amazing.
I know, it's magic. I didn't find it out, but I realized how cool this could be. So I'm on the APDT DEI committee, and we had gathered up a bunch of information regarding trainers of color. This is probably another podcast topic for you, DEI and animal training. But we got all this data, and of course, we had written a survey to get the data, and the survey was not written in a way that was very friendly for data. And somebody actually told me, this will take 100 hours. And I imagined her just running away, like screaming like, no. And come to find out that we had data analysts on our team. And
that is an amazing skill set yeah. that I do not have.
You know, wave your magic wand.
Yeah.
And now we're working on more projects with our data analytical folks to, you know, figure out what we can do more with technology. So we raised a bunch of money specifically for using biometric collars, and we're going to put something together. I'm so excited.
And the amount of research that can be done, the things that could be, yeah, I think identifying your volunteers' strengths, because I walking dogs and creating enrichment is very, very important. But I always tell people, I was like, not everyone should be fostering for a variety of reasons. There are so many other, like writing grants. Oh my gosh. I know so many amazing grant writers. That is not my skill set. Hey, shelters, find one of those people. Or they may be really good at photography. Again, not my skill set, but they can, because that matters. The photos of the animals will get them adopted quicker. There's actually like research to support this.
Yes, the quality of the photos matters. It's not just a matter of getting some image up there, you know.
And there's so many people, like you said, that they may feel, I meet tons of people who aren't behavior specialists or vet techs like myself. And they're like, I really want to do. And I'm like, oh my gosh, they need you. You could do this, this, and this, and this. But they're assuming if they're not hands-on, I'm like, oh gosh, we need you. They need you.
Oh, sure. We have our administrative volunteers.
Yes. And
there's Roger. I'm going to call out Roger. He does our puppy and kitten kindergarten wrangling. And he also helps us with our TOS cases. So we have something called Thinking Outside the Shelter, or TOS. And that's where folks who might be on the precipice of bringing their animals to the shelter can reach out for either behavior consulting, or maybe they're having trouble affording food or, you know, or medical care. So if they you know, write to us, then we can help them with maybe their vaccine.
Yeah. What can we do to keep your animal in your home? Because many people, although it may not feel like that, I work with a lot of pet retention programs, and I've seen people who will lose their home if they can't move with their animal. I mean, we need to support them. And obviously I have a food bank here. If I could supply you with food and that animal could stay at that home and you can have your animal. Heck yeah, man. That's another amazing program.
Yes. Go on, please. Yeah. One thing that I think is so wonderful about these programs is that despite the fact that they're geared towards folks who might not have the resources to afford these services for their pets, we don't force people to, you know, prove, you know, that they're in a rough situation. You know, we might say, you know, this is a program specifically for people who may be in a rough patch, but, you know, we're not going to shame you. And to me, that's huge, because not a lot of people are going to say, I can't afford to feed my pet and just to save a buck, you know, they're not.
Cause that's a very challenging. I mean, just to ask for help. I reinforce all my clients when they first call me, thank you so much for reaching out. Because I think just asking for help is very challenging for any human. And then they love their animals and they might feel, especially because of some weird myths out there, like if you can't afford an animal, horrible things that I've talked about on the podcast before, that we, especially guys, it's the general public's one thing, but as animal professionals, we should not feel that way or be saying that. But unfortunately, that is something that is very so. They're afraid that I know some people that are afraid to reach out for help because they're afraid their animal will get taken away. I mean, real talk, like these are the things that we have to empathize and understand where they're coming from. And not only, again, another beautiful way you guys have built relationships with your community. And not only have you built relationships with volunteers and the community, you guys also have a really good relationship with your medical team, which this is something that I've been surprised about, because I work with tons of shelters and veterinary clinics around the world, and a division between behavior and medical teams, or just shelter care and medical teams in a shelter setting. It is very common for them not to communicate with each other, or for them to communicate with to each other with tension.
Yes.
And I'm going to be honest, it does surprise. I'm still a little surprised by it, but now that I've seen it as a chronic issue, I am doing what I can to support that relationship. But I know that you guys have a great relationship between your support staff, medical, behavior. Can you share about how you guys have worked on that relationship and maybe some tips on how shelters can kind of overcome that challenge of the division between those two teams?
Yeah, it's interesting. I think that if you're not in the field, you might not realize that it's a thing, but it's something I've experienced many times in the variety of organizations where I've worked. I have one story I want to tell
to
the folks who might not realize how bad it is, but I used to work at an animal shelter, and they would disagree about which behavior cases we should be working on, but the medical team, but they wouldn't say anything. They wouldn't say, oh, well, you know, I think we should, euthanize this animal rather than continuing on, which I think is a valid discussion, but they would wait until I was on vacation and they would euthanize them. Then I would come back and they will have called the animal in from foster and then euthanize them with the foster there. Terrible, toxic stuff. So having come from that, and then not saying that it wasn't a journey in our shelter too, because, you know, it wasn't always, and it's still not, you know, just rainbows and unicorns.
Of course.
Over here. I do remember a time when our wellness manager, Erin Stewart, who I feel so comfortable saying her name because she knows that we went on this journey together. That in the beginning, I'll never forget that I was handling a dog for her. And then one of the other techs was like, hey, maybe we should use some, it's so funny, but this was a long time ago, guys.
Context.
For folks. It was a long time ago. And so the other tech says, hey, let's like use some spray cheese, you know, to distract this dog. It's pretty difficult. And Erin says, oh, I hate it when people do that. And I didn't say anything, but I was just like, well, you know, I was thinking, well, what would you rather us do? Just like wrangle this dog? Because at that time, that's what we did.
You were kind of taking that information in. And I think, because again, like, what are the whys? And then now I'm confident because I've been put in those situations. And now I'm educated and confident enough that I can explain why, meet them where they're at, address their concerns, and usually they're like, okay, Tabitha, let me let you do your job as a handler. But also I remember just being put in a lot of ethically uncomfortable and unsafe handling situations because I was afraid to advocate not only for myself but for that animal. So
right. And I have to admit that I was in that position too. And even though we were equals, we were both managers at the time.
Yeah,
I respected Erin, but this is not a sign of respect. It's my lack of self-confidence, or my maybe a communication deficit on my part. I'm so much better now.
I think that's a great point, because sometimes I may feel I've been through this. You just worded it wonderfully though, where again, back in the day, I would be like, I would get upset at a veterinarian or another person. And then now looking back, I'm like, oh, I never actually talked. Like I think we both created narratives in our head and neither of us were malicious. And now we strongly dislike each other, or I'm not going to work with that person based on a bunch of narrative stuff, versus if I would have said something kindly and respectfully, obviously professionally, usually I can have, especially in my experience now, I can have tons of conversations. It's very rare that people are not open to it. But I know 10 years ago, I would just be like, that was bullshit. What was that? But then I'm like, I'm just being honest. And it's interesting because talking back with some of the colleagues, because I'm friends with a lot of those people still, and we've all grown quite a lot. And we were like, that's so funny because I felt like this at that time. And a lot of the times we were similar in our thought process, but we just wouldn't communicate.
Yeah. And you know, I bet you you're just as passionate now as you were before, if not more passionate. And the only way you're going to get anywhere with that passion is through communication. I want to say also not directly relevant, but at our shelter, we're all reading this book called Nonviolent Communication. I don't know if you've ever heard.
Oh, I haven't. Do I have to add it to my list?
I think you should. It's by Marshall Rosenberg, and it's about the fact that we don't, at least in our Western culture, don't have the vocabulary in to address these difficult conversations. Our first gut reaction is to judge the other person and just and use words to judge them. Like if you were driving and somebody cut you off, the first thing you're going to think, or not you, but the first thing that typically think is, you know, what's that idiot doing or something. You're going to come up with some
words. Why are they on their phone? What are they doing? Even though I can't tell what they're doing.
Yeah, you can't tell what they're doing, but you're going to find some way to judge them instead of. So Marshall Rosenberg talks about putting, when you use words, try to put more good into out there into the world, which sounds so hippy dippy, but it makes sense because you're going to be thinking about, you know, what are you feeling? What needs do you have that need to be met at that time that, you know, are eliciting those feelings? And then also, what is the other person feeling too? And what needs do they have to be met? And just, you know, if I could go back in time to the Melissa of that day when Erin said that she didn't like using treats during exams, and just thought about where she was coming from and then my needs and my feelings, it would have been so different. And we probably would have started a lot sooner. but so, you know, oh, well, we can't go back in time. But when we can, that's one of the things I'm going to do. So later on, Erin and I were, we were working together to give this difficult dog. He was notoriously difficult, not aggressive, but just really wiggly. He had had a pretty rough past due to this a school where they used shock collar training. It's hard to explain the process, but he became really difficult to to handle.
He generalized humans approaching, most likely, I'm just being honest, like most likely he generalized humans approaching to pain and discomfort.
Sure.
Or he just lived in a state of, I'm always on high alert and hypervigilant because I am going to, like, imagine if I was just going to, hey, Melissa, I'm going to punch you 3 times in the next week, but I'm not going to tell you when. You're going to live in, so most likely all of that probably played a part.
Can you just imagine too that he also just loved people, so he was just always conflicted all the
time. A lot of conflict induced, like, I want to say hi, but then when I say hi, I get injured or it hurts, or I get
out of that, or he was actually so bad that if you just talked to him at all, if you said anything to him, he would start showing these scratching you and jumping on you and panicking. People had you know, I invested in clothes that had lifetime guarantees with this dog because he kept scratching my clothes. And but anyway, so he was a great dog, but difficult to give vaccinations to. And you know, because of my lack of self-confidence, I went along with Erin's direction at that time, or maybe not her direction. I didn't advocate for this dog where I really should have. And we ended up, you know, using these old school restraint methods, and it did not go well. Nobody got hurt, but nobody had a good time. And we were all sweating and panting, and not in a good way after.
Yeah.
And so we just decided at that moment, like, this is not the way. And we were just, I remember we were in the shelter living room after the event, and we were just sitting on the couch there, and we were just sweaty and like, this is not the way. We can't do this. And so I'm maybe slow on the uptake or something, but I just was like, hey, you know, I trained bears and the bears didn't like being bedded either, but this is what we did. Why don't we do this with the dogs?
Love it.
So that's when we started with this particular dog. So since I'd always trained bears through protected contact, because of course.
Of course. I hope so. If you weren't saying that, I would have given a little disclaimer.
And so that's how I started with dogs, because that was my first gut instinct from, mm-hmm. or not instinct, but that's just what I'd learned to do. And so we had the dog on the other side of a barrier. And this is funny because there's an article about it in the IAAC journal from, I don't know, a while back. I'm sure we can share the link to that. And there's a photo of Erin, and Erin is in the condo. Like, she is inside this crate because the protected Julio was getting protected from Erin.
Right.
Because that makes sense, right? Like, because he thought that he felt unsafe because of her. So she should be in the cage. And then we taught him to press his, you know, parts of his body up against the kennel so that she could give him his vaccinations that way. And because he had total control, if he wanted to, he could move away.
Cooperative care, man.
Yeah. Yep. And I don't even know that we said cooperative care back then. We probably, maybe we called it husbandry training. I don't know.
And I think that's kind of what's happened with the, because through experience, trial and error, learning, right? I think a lot of us have, for example, like, you guys were put into a situation. You did the best with what you knew in that moment. Because, for example, I was taught traditional restraint. What I was taught in tech school is, I haven't utilized any of those techniques in quite a long time. But that's what I was taught. And then it didn't go well at all for anybody. And you guys reflected, instead of being like, it's the dog and all this. That's a whole nother. Not looking at actually what was going on. And you're like, okay, how can we problem solve this? Let's talk your experiences, the vet's experiences. And then you came up with a solution. And then it worked so well, it actually probably helped to really create a bond between you and the veterinary team.
Yes, we it was,
because that trust is there. From my aspect, now that we're like reflecting and talking, I do think that's a reason why sometimes I see divisions. I'm not justifying it, but I think there's some lack of trust there. And again, narratives created on both sides, where, like you said, I've been put in situations where I'm like, I should have just like talked or said something, because it's something that, and now obviously you shouldn't be punished, because there are environments that people get punished for asking questions, which is a huge red flag, and you should be working on that on a larger level. I'm not saying that those environments don't exist. I'm very aware of it, but am I working really hard to change those environments? Yes. So I think a big part of helping your veterinary team and shelter staff team be cohesive is communication, which is super corny, but it's real, y'all. Like, talking, expressing concerns, not assuming that vet's just trying to make your life harder, or that handler, if, like you said, if that handler isn't familiar, because another thing I've recognized in shelter med is many people they're told to give vaccines or draw blood. They were never taught on how to hold a syringe. They were never taught without an animal, guys. They were never. So something I've started teaching at my handling labs is how to hold a syringe, how to use a butterfly to draw blood, because bless these shelter staff, there's no credentialed veterinary staff. And if it is, and I'm not throwing shade, but I'm just being real, it's the same person from 20 years ago who may have not done CE in 20 years. So they're still teaching fairly outdated stuff to these. So again, we're just setting up everyone to fail. So that's something I've recognized working with shelters to the extent I do now. I'll be honest, I would teach handling, and then I realized, oh, you were thrown into, here's a needle, poke this animal. And you guys, if you poke anything enough, blood comes out, but that doesn't make it right. Sorry. But again, that poor shelter employee was like so upset. And I'm like, oh my gosh, no one even taught you how to hold a syringe. And now we're asking you to poke an animal that's fearful and moving. Oh my gosh. Like, it was like very, I know I should have realized that years ago, but it was a really eye-opening thing for me. And I think sometimes other veterinary professionals may feel that, may have done that too, accidentally, and said they should just know this. And that is not how it is at all.
Yeah. You really have to feel for these folks, because they're just put in this position where you get punished for not knowing, and then you're not prepared. And your safety isn't often taken into consideration. Yeah. So of course they're going to be feeling unsafe and maybe defensive. So yeah, I like to say, and I want a t-shirt that says humans are animals too, because sometimes
we love
give
that.
So much consideration to the non-human animals, at least, you know, over here in this field, but yeah. We don't realize that that person that you might feel, you know, if you're in behavior and then somebody, you know, there's the vet tech that you feel is kind of your enemy because they don't want to use cheese, or maybe they don't want to use some pre-exam meds, like your vet doesn't want to do that. You know, look at yourselves as in a team. And like what I was saying about nonviolent communication is try to understand, where is this person coming from? Just like you would some of our non-human people in our lives that we seem to give a lot more consideration to. Yep, humans are animals too.
I think the biggest tips on how shelters can kind of overcome this challenge is communicating is a big part, and communicating with emotional intelligence and communication skills, which takes time to learn. You guys, trust me, my communication skills from 10 years ago and now, whoa. But as humans, we're always growing and improving, which is beautiful. And that's what I love about shelter and vet med, because we call it practicing, because we are always improving, which it's probably my favorite part of my field that I work in. Now, does everyone approach it that way? Maybe not, but a large majority does. And I know many of you out there do. So I think the biggest thing is communication skills, and being empathetic towards the other party, because they may be over threshold and struggling. And I'm not justifying that behavior, to those emotions, to allow them to not be kind to you. But that's something I've recognized the last few years on texts that made me cry and other things that we've all probably dealt with, which again, I'm not justifying their behavior, but they were suffering and they were over threshold and they were in a chronic state of arousal, like just things that I recognize now knowing behavior. And I probably would have handled them trying to make me cry differently, but with more empathy. I know there's a function to behavior, and it usually isn't to fuck Tabitha over.
No.
That is not usually the function.
And if you think about it, like if you know, you had a bad day and you got bitten by an animal. So I've been bitten a couple of times. And one time it was at an animal care and control, and I was collaring this little feral kitten. Mm-hmm. And I will never forget, the ACO said, "Watch your finger." And there, my finger, and that little kitten bit my finger so hard that his head was trembling with the effort. Aww. And it was such a tiny little animal, but it hurt.
Yeah.
More than so many other things in my life. And I've given birth, people. And I'm walking to my desk and I'm just like crying, and there's like this trail of blood following me behind.
Oh, geez.
But was I mad? No. Did I curse the kitten? No. You know, because I knew where the kitten was coming from. But why is it so hard then, when you have a conflict with another human being and they make you cry, like the kitten made me cry, but you know, there's this blame game, you know? So, I mean, I think that this is where we're going in our field. And I'm so glad that our shelter is not just non-human animal focused. You know, we think about the people who also love the animals. And we actually think about people who don't love animals too, because they matter and they affect animals. So if you don't love those community cats, that's okay. We're still going to help you.
Yeah. You want less community cats. So do I. Let's party. We may have different reasons for that, but I think that is a wonderful way to end. I know we shared a lot of beautiful stories, and I'm sure many of you out there can relate. Tabitha loves being vulnerable. That's me. So I really appreciate you and your shelter and everything you do. I'll be sharing a few of the book and a few articles along with the shelter information that Melissa works at in the show notes. So be sure to check those out and support her. But thank you so much for being here and taking time out of your busy day to chat with me.
Yes, it was so wonderful. And Tabitha, I cannot wait to see you here in Houston in May.
Yay, I'm gonna squeeze you and we're gonna run. I can't wait.
Yes. Do you want to run with us? Run with us. It's gonna be so much fun.
Yeah, I will be at the IABBC conference speaking. And I would love to see all of you. I'm going to be around at a lot of conferences in the next few months. So please find me. I tend to have colored hair and I'm tattooed and very pasty. So I'm pretty easy to find, but don't hesitate to reach out. But yeah, if you are in Houston, definitely make a point to stop at and support Melissa's amazing shelter. Thank you.
Oh yeah. Yes. Visit the shelter. We're doing a workshop over here. So you can come, you can meet some of our animals that have gone through our fearful animal programs, and you can eat with us and chat with us. You can eat some tasty vegan food.
Yes, I'm so excited. Thank you to everyone for listening, and also a huge thanks to everyone who stopped and introduced themselves or shared love for the podcast at BMX, and also who shared love for my behavior consulting business, Chirps and Chatter, and just me in general. I really felt the love at BMX, and I can't thank all of you enough.